Okay, good afternoon. I will call this meeting to order. Chair Sundeen will join us shortly, so I will be chairing this committee until he returns. This meeting will be held in accordance with the House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. Mr. Smith, could you please call the roll to establish a quorum?
Yes, Sundeen, he's excused for now. Vice Chair or Co-Chair Vang.
Present.
Thank present. Anderson.
Anderson present.
Anderson present. Eklund.
Present.
Burkle.
Present.
Burkle present. Hansen R.
Hansen R present.
Hansen R present. Hansen J.
Hansen J present.
Hansen J present. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn present. Lippert.
Lippert present.
Lippert present. Lewick.
Lewick present.
Lewick present. Miller.
Miller present.
Miller present. Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. Thompson.
Thompson present.
Thompson present. We do have a quorum, Madam Chair.
A quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is approval of minutes. The minutes for the 8th meeting of the Ag Committee were provided with the meeting material and are posted online. Representative Lippert, what's your motion?
So I've read the minutes, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes from February 8th.
Representative Lippert moved the minutes for February 8th. Any questions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Moving next on the agenda item, we are getting close to the end of our budget program review and the governor's budget recommendation. All the meeting materials was provided ahead of the meeting and they are posted on the committee website. First, I'd like to welcome Dr. Neeser. Please introduce yourself and feel free to begin.
There we go. Thank you, Chair Vang and committee members. I think you guys can hear me okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. My name is Dr. Nicole Neeser. I'm the director of the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I'm here today to discuss, just give you a brief overview of what the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division does, and as well as how the governor's budget works into that, our division. So I think there's some slides to share. There we go. All right, and go right into that first next slide. Great. The Dairy and Meat Inspection Division, our job is to ensure the safety of the food supply by conducting regulatory-based inspection work for our dairy, meat, poultry, and egg products. So I like to explain it as sort of anything that comes from animals is kind of the area that we cover. So animals that are harvested for food. Our work is food safety based. So the regulations are based around keeping our food supply safe. But our work is also commerce based. So both programs have a really strong federally associated regulation or oversight. And our inspections are mandated for our products, for the dairy and meat products produced in Minnesota to be sold interstate between states, as well as intrastate with respect to the meat and poultry products. We also do some work responding to emergencies and outbreaks when they do occur. So next slide, please. All right, so we implement our program activities in a number of different ways. Primarily, we do this through inspection work. So we're observing the practices of farmers and manufacturers using on-site inspections. So many of you may be familiar with dairy farm inspections. We do inspections of both grade A and grade B or manufacturing dairy farms. We do inspections of sort of all aspects of the dairy industry, from bulk haulers to tankers to ice cream manufacturers to milk bottlers and so on. On the meat side, this is more confined to the processing plants. So we're doing inspections in slaughter plants, and processing plants. And traditionally, people think of processing as sort of your local butcher shop activities, such as producing hams and bacons, but also it's important to understand that it extends to a lot of different kinds of activities also, such as providing meals that contain meat to daycares, or catering, some kinds of catering activities, or selling sausages to the Twins baseball team, or even a lot of different ethnic products have kind of joined the ranks of products produced in plants we overseas, such as sambusas, and other kinds of specialty sausage products. So the, really a wide variety of things that we inspect that contain meat. We also collect samples to monitor product safety. So the, most of these samples for both the dairy and meat inspection program are mandated by the federal program requirements. And those samples are tested for pathogens such as E. coli and Salmonella and Listeria. We do a lot of outreach. So especially during this last year with COVID, we've been out there trying to assist farmers and processors, trying to get them under inspection or understand what the requirements are so that they can market their products both safely and according to the regulatory requirements. A little bit unique to our dairy inspection program, we also have a certified industry inspection program where we partner with industry personnel to conduct inspections. They conduct inspections, they collect official regulatory samples on our behalf. They also do what's called temporary reseals. So they will reseal pasteurizers and plants so that they can continue to operate on a temporary basis until we can get there to do the complete inspection. So really the dairy industry has a really remarkable history of partnering both regulatory and industry to accomplish the necessary components of the regulatory program. As mentioned before, we do a lot of guidance working with prospective operators and showing them how to meet the requirements. And then we also issue something called certificates of free sale to Minnesota meat and dairy companies so that they can export products internationally. Primarily, this is on the dairy side. There's many companies in Minnesota that do export dairy products internationally, and providing these certificates is an important piece of ensuring they can do that freely. So next slide. All right, for DMID, our base budget is essentially split three ways. So federal funds is a little bit under a third. General funds is a little bit, is right at about a third, and dedicated funds is about a little over a third. So the federal funds come in primarily through a cooperative agreement match for a meat inspection program, and the dedicated funds come primarily for our dairy inspection program work and come from fees paid by the industry. All right, next slide. All right, so as I mentioned, you know, we are funded kind of equally by the general fund, dedicated, and federal funding. We have about 51 FTEs, 55 employees when we're fully staffed. We have a number of part-time employees in the different programs, as well as a number of staff that work cross programs. So virtually all of our administrative support staff work across programs to support both dairy and meat inspection, as well as outreach and training activities. Our dairy inspection program has a little over 13 field inspection full-time equivalents that conduct about 7,000 inspections a year. Those, again, are the inspections of dairy farms, dairy plants, tankers, haulers, and other parts of the dairy industry. Our meat inspection program is a little bigger, and we have just under 18 FTEs. They conduct over 9,300 inspections per year. Those inspections range from one full day of slaughter inspection, where an inspector might be at a plant all day long, or just a 15-minute, half-hour processing inspection where they're going to a plant number of times during the week but don't need to spend as much time there. We also support those field inspection FTEs with our compliance officers. So those are the folks kind of working with those that are unlicensed or unpermitted, maybe not operating according to the regulations, trying to get them to move to operate in accordance with the regulations. Also doing a lot of outreach. Our operations and outreach staff, we have auditors on the dairy inspection program side that are required to manage the interstate milk shipment program, which allows grade A products to be sold across state lines. And then we have, of course, our field inspection supervisors and some veterinarians on staff to support the program activities and actually an essential piece of the meat inspection program. All right, next slide. All right, so for the dairy inspection, I know this is always a common question is so kind of where are we at in farm numbers? So as of 1/1/2021, we're at 2,200 grade A farms, 125 grade B farms. This over the calendar year of 2020, we lost 125 farms, which is a little over, I think, between 5 and 6% of what we have. This is really, the loss is a much slower rate than the previous year. The previous year we had lost about 12%. So that has definitely started to settle in a little bit. And this time of year, we start to see a number of our goat farms kind of that were seasonally dried off coming back on the market. So you'll actually see here in February and March that number of grade B farms will go up. And then we'll start to see those farms stay on the market until the fall. And so they'll come off in the fall. So we tend to see a little bit of an increase here in the spring months, and then start to really get a better idea of where the farm numbers are heading throughout the rest of the year. For our plant numbers, we've got about 70 manufacturing plants. And so manufacturing grade dairy products are butter and ice cream, and a few others, cheese, I guess, being a major one. And so we have a number of really strong manufacturing industry here in Minnesota. A number of cheese plants. We have a large butter plant and a large ice cream manufacturer, as well as a number of very small plants that have started and are starting to do pretty well in this pandemic time where folks are getting a little closer to those small plants and wanting some more local products. We have also 37 grade A plants. We have lost a few of those grade A plants during the past year or two. Due to market changes. And the grade A plants are plants that process milk for grade A products, which are fluid bottled milk, so milk in bottles or jugs from a grocery store, as well as yogurt, cottage cheese, and sour cream. I think we're really fortunate here in Minnesota that we have a very diverse dairy processing industry. We also have a very strong dried product processing industry, which can those products are not as perishable. And so when we have times of surplus, those plants are sort of able to pick up some of that slack and drive more products and store it for future use. We also do inspections of tankers and haulers. And altogether, we have about 1,100 of those that are licensed and permitted. We have seen a fairly significant reduction in the number of haulers more recently. As it becomes more difficult to find individuals that are willing to do that work and continue. But we do see a pretty high turnover in that area and so do license on every annual basis about 1,100 of those. As mentioned before, a large portion of our dairy inspection budget comes from the agricultural fund. So fees account for usually 65 to 70% of the dairy inspection funding support, with the general fund piece coming in a little bit under one third there. The fees come from fees paid from dairy farms for inspections, but primarily they are from what we call the processor's fee and procurement fees. So very small fees paid on pounds of milk procured by dairy plants in Minnesota and on sort of what's the equivalent of grade A products sold retail in Minnesota. So that would also apply to out-of-state companies that sell products into Minnesota. So current trends, as I mentioned, fewer dairy farms. That does seem to have slowed quite a bit this past year. We continue to see increased numbers of small dairy manufacturing plants. So small ice cream manufacturers, small cheese makers. We've actually added a small bottler this year, which we don't see those too often, but we do have a new one this year, and we also have one that's going to be making yogurt as well. So we've seen a lot of interest in this area. Unfortunately, a number of the ice cream manufacturers were pretty hard hit by the COVID pandemic. So for just because of changes in the market and demand, a number of those plants were hit pretty hard. We're hoping to see them rebound and continue on, and or new plants starting to kind of take up that slack as things continue to change. And as we've been seeing for the past few years, we continue to see an increased number of goat milk farms. So we see typically well over 100 grade B goat farms during our peak season, which will be here in April, May, June, and July. And we have a pretty large goat milk plant in terms of goat milk plants in the central part of the state that is doing very well, and as well as a number of plants in neighboring states that take milk from Minnesota goat farms. As I mentioned really early on here, our inspections are based on safety. For grade A, those requirements are based on the pasteurized milk ordinance. That system, grade A system, also means that we have to satisfy inspection requirements, frequencies, as well as the quality of farms and plants in order to continue to sell products across state lines for interstate commerce. All right, next slide. All right, for the meat and poultry inspection program, we have our state Equal To meat inspection program. And for those of you who may not be familiar with that, Equal To means equal to USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service requirements. This means that we have to do what's called continuous inspection. So all the animals slaughtered under at that plant under Equal To inspection must be inspected both before slaughter and after slaughter to make sure the animal was healthy and that all the parts and carcass parts and materials that come from that carcass for food are wholesome and safe. So that's a really intense kind of inspection. That's a little bit different than other kinds of inspection work done by our dairy inspection program, as well as even our food or feed safety inspection program. Plants that are under the Minnesota Equal To program can wholesale their products in Minnesota, but they cannot wholesale products into other states. Plants that want to wholesale to other states have to pursue inspection with the USDA. We also oversee our custom exempt operators. So these are operators that provide slaughter or processing services for the owner of the animal. So traditionally this has been a farmer brings their animal to this plant, they have it slaughtered, they bring it home. That meat is considered not for sale, but as we've all seen more recently, a lot of people are able to take advantage of this for direct marketing. So they may sell an individual a half an animal or a quarter of an animal or even a 16th or eighth of an animal. And that animal goes to these plants and they can go pick up their product and have it cut according to their specifications. The key is that this meat is not for sale. So once the animal is slaughtered and the meat is packaged, cannot be sold. It has to be sold. The animal has to be sold before slaughter. This type of processing has become very in very high demand during the last year, and we've been seeing a pretty significant increase in custom exempt plant numbers, as I believe I testified to in a previous hearing. Our budget for fiscal year 22-23 is about $3 million for general fund, almost $4 million for federal. This does work out to be actually about a 50-50% split due to calculations of an in-kind indirect fund. And so we essentially get a 50% program match from the federal government for our meat inspection activities. Some of the trends, we continue to have interest in ethnic or sort of non-traditional slaughter and processing. The federal regulations continue to be complex, and so it's really important or we believe it's very important that we're doing a good job with outreach and assistance to help plants navigate the system, the small operators, and make sure that they understand what they're getting into. And we continue to see more compliance issues. Of course, this year's pandemic brought many interesting issues as people tried to find places to slaughter hogs and you know, weren't able to secure places in the licensed plants. And so we had a pretty busy year in terms of compliance issues. But I think we've also had some really good opportunities for outreach and really have heard from folks that they appreciate that we're out there and sharing some of that information. Very similar to dairy, our inspections are for safety, but there's also a commerce aspect to it. So really our equal to plants, in order to sell products, wholesale products, you must have inspected, equal to inspected or USDA inspected meat. So it's really a mandatory kind of inspection. All right, there we go. And then just a few small programs that we also administer in our division, a program called USDA Shell Egg Surveillance, which is a 100% reimbursement program where we do grading of eggs in some smaller egg producing farms. We also have a state egg inspection fund that helps support outreach for egg producers and grading activities. And then we do also administer the venison donation program, which is supported by money that comes in from the DNR each year. And then as mentioned earlier, we do have a food safety certificate of free sale that is supported by fees that come through the users, the people who request those certificates in the agricultural fund. The governor's budget recommendation, our meat inspection program fits in here. As you've probably heard earlier, the need to expand livestock and meat processing is definitely there. So as a part of the governor's budget, there is a request related to grants, but there also is a request to invest another $110,000 in each year of the biennium to meet the demand at new and existing businesses. This is the inspection demand. As mentioned, our inspections are mandatory. In order to complete mandatory inspections, we have to have staff available to do those inspections. So as the need for inspection increases, we definitely are seeing a need for increased numbers of inspectors or availability of inspectors to do that work. And I think that is the end of my section there.
Thank you, Dr. Neisser. I do see that we have one more testifier from the Food and Feed Division, so we'll get started with that testimony, and then I will open up the floor for questions from members of the committee. Welcome, Ms. Simon. Feel free to get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Simon. I'm the Director of the Food and Feed Safety Division at the Department of Agriculture. So next slide, please. Going in a little bit different order than Dr. Neisser had provided you, but overall for the Food and Feed Safety Division, our budget consists of a combination of general funds, dedicated funds, both through agricultural fund as well as special revenue accounts, and then federal funds, typically in grants and cooperative agreements that we're receiving. Our special revenue funds are specific to contract work that individual programs complete. And I'll be covering those through the rest of the presentation. And then our general funds are certain programs, special allotments, as well as some protected services accounts as well. Next slide, please. Overall for the Food and Feed Safety Division, we have four separate regulatory programs that we're overseeing. So there's a commercial feed program, a separated manufactured food program, a retail food program, as well as a produce safety program. These programs are designed to address the safety of products, the individual production and safety of those items, as well as achieving consumer and animal health protection through the management and distribution of that, as well as similar to Dr. Neisser's presentation, ensuring that there's orderly commerce. So truth in advertising and the materials that consumers are receiving are accurate and truthfully represented. In terms of size and scope, we have our license and permit registration counts over on the side. This is just a snapshot in time. These numbers do change, pretty much every day as businesses are licensed or notify us that they're no longer in operation. But of note, there's a few different combinations that go into these different programs. So commercial feed licensing is pretty straightforward with that program. The wholesale food processor and manufacturer license, the wholesale food handler licenses, and the food broker licenses are overseen by our manufactured food program. The retail food handler and associated mobile licenses are inspected mostly by our retail food program. And also of note on this, I went ahead and put our cottage food producer registration numbers on. It's not a licensed program, But it is a significant registration period, a significant registration block that we have quite a bit of interaction with. And so I thought it was good to kind of represent it here with the rest of our license numbers as well. Next slide, please. The commercial feed program, they cover both the distributed animal feed as well as the pet food. And so these are going to be the mill and distribution facilities as well as the transport vehicles. You'll see a trend through here where inspections are going to be conducted based on the risk of the activities. So based on the individual facilities and what activities they are choosing to do for their business, either risks associated to the processing or risks associated to the finished products that they make, that's really the driver for what inspections are going to occur and the frequency that they do occur. This is the program that does the most of our product sampling as well. So this would be finished product as well as in-process product that is sampled for a variety of analytes to ensure safety, but again, as well as orderly commerce, making sure that it has the appropriate quality and truth and representation as it's being sold. Part of these inspections also do have a significant element of record verification, because that is a way that we do active monitoring for the safety of the products for the days that there's the days of production where we're not actively inspecting. So this is one of the main differences between the dairy and meat programs that Dr. Nieser had presented about, as well as all of the programs in the Food and Feed Safety Division, is that our, while licensing is required and part of our licensing activities do include, assessing facilities and products the conditions in which they're produced, our inspections are done based on risk, and they are not done at the same level of frequency that those meat and dairy inspections are mandated to be for their particular programs for interstate commerce. So that's one main difference. Back to the commercial feed program, there's also a significant amount of work that goes into pet food monitoring. So again, we've got manufacturing inspections that are occurring, but additionally, there are listing requirements for these products to be sold in Minnesota. And a significant amount of work has gone into reviewing the labels for those products to make sure that they're being represented accurately, but also that those products are safe and are meeting the necessary requirements. And then the commercial feed program is one of our programs that conducts inspections under contract. And so the counterpart that we work for is the Food and Drug Administration. So we do have a similar series of regulations that we enforce under state authorities. And to make sure that we have the best use of resources, we extend our staff and conduct those inspections under contract for the federal government in lieu of the federal staff coming and doing the inspections themselves. So we contract, we conduct the activities, and then we report it back to FDA, and then they pay us for that service that we provide. Next slide. Our manufactured food program is the next one up. So this is for the food processors, and we conduct licensing inspection activities for those manufacturers. So again, the inspections are based on the risk of the food activities. The types of facilities that this would apply to is pretty much everything that was not already covered by Dr. Nieser. So beverages, canneries, bakeries, prepared foods, so thinking like potato salads, condiments, and ingredient manufacturers as well. Pretty much everything across the gamut who is selling to somebody else who will then resell the product is going to be licensed here as a manufacturer. Part of those inspections does include sampling both of the product and the processing environment. This is done in a very targeted manner to make sure that we are using the best information in order to make regulatory decisions. So those samples are really based to either support adverse conditions that we see or to do more information gathering in certain processing environments. This is also a program that does the certificate of free sale or exports certificates. So this is done in collaboration with the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division, but the ones that we issue are specific to the food manufacturing operations rather than the dairy operations. But our process is very similar. And again, those are certificates that we provide to exporters to demonstrate that they have records and that those facilities are being overseen under our regulatory capacity. This inspection program also licenses and inspects warehouses. So most of these are just packaged food or raw ingredient warehouses. And then that's the distribution point at which they get to their the retail operations. So again, it's a similar set of rules conducted on risk, but it's a different type of inspection with a little bit different needs. This is the second program that also does federal contracted inspections. And again, it's also for the Food and Drug Administration. We again adopt the rules that are similar or by reference from the Food and Drug Administration in our own statutes, but we conduct them under our state authority, but we conduct them with additional reporting requirements to the federal contract and then report back to them and then are paid for that service. And again, this is a way that we can work collaboratively so that a food facility would only be getting one inspection from a state inspector, rather than two inspections, one from the state and one from the federal government. So for the retail food program, it's a little bit different. So this is a program that requires a facility plan review prior to opening. And so we've got staff who are dedicated to doing that, and they really review the facility and equipment plans that are put together by the business. And it is, like I said, required to open. And so we've got staff to facilitate that process and make sure that it's streamlined and that they get good support so that operators can have good feedback and be able to get set up successfully prior to opening. And then the staff also do licensing inspections based on risk. The retail food area that the Department of Agriculture covers is groceries, bakeries, meat departments, delis, convenience stores, as well as other packaged food stores. So this is pretty much everything except food service or institutional use. So the general design is going to be around grocery or packaged food types of sales. A key element of our retail food program is that we do have a delegation of authority to local boards of health. And we currently have delegation agreements with seven local city and county programs. That is a significant oversight responsibility. It is something that we work quite collaboratively to be able to support and have consistency in interpretation make sure that we have staff available to be able to assist in getting support for both the inspection staff as well as the facilities for continuity of services. Next slide. Lastly is our produce safety program. So this is the youngest program. We're in the fifth year of a five-year cooperative agreement with the federal counterpart in FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to be able to implement new activities related to the Food Safety Modernization Act. So with the Food Safety Modernization Act, there were new rules specific to on-farm growing practices. And this cooperative agreement was designed to be able to support growers in transitioning into this new regulatory environment where there was not previously regulatory oversight. So that is what is unique to this program, is that it's heavily focused on providing outreach and support to growers in being able to meet the requirements of this new regulation. As part of that, in our program, we've established a significant number of stakeholder relationships and collaborative activities through the last few years. And a lot of this is really designed around providing access to educational materials and other training materials and other ways that we can support growers in being able to have access to support in order to comply, whether it's information, whether it's knowledge, whether it's funds or other ways that they can access food safety experts to be able to consult with their businesses to comply with the safety requirements for growing. Additionally, we've set up a safety inspection component as part of the requirement for that. And again, inspections are always based on risk, both on the individual products risk that is being grown, as well as on the handling activities that are being used on the farm. And those safety inspections cover the growing, harvesting, packing, and holding of those produce items. Next slide. Some additional roles that our division plays is we administer the Governor's Food Safety and Defense Task Force. So this is a compilation of different leaders in the industry to come together and be able to support food safety and defense efforts within Minnesota. And so that's appointed members as well as an open meeting for other food operations to be able to participate and have access to information. We also maintain our rapid response team. And so this is a national leader team, and how it is that we respond and work collaboratively with the Department of Health to respond to foodborne illness outbreaks. So the Department of Health does a lot of the epidemiology work. And so they identify when outbreaks are occurring. And based on their information, we then do follow-up activities to trace that food through the food system and be able to intervene in those facilities to find interventions at the operations. So that's really about preventing additional illnesses from happening by getting control of that product, but then also getting input from those outbreak scenarios back into the food food manufacturers or retail environment for how it is that additional outbreaks can be prevented in the future by doing lessons learned activities. As I'd mentioned previously, we also oversee the cottage food registration. So the cottage food law is an exemption from food licensing. So it is certain requirements that if you meet them, allows you to produce and sell food from a home without a license. And at this time we do, it is a very large program and there is quite a bit of outreach associated with it to make sure that those operators who are choosing to know when that's an option for them, but then also how they can continue to comply and then the streamlining the administrative activities and other support for the stakeholders who are involved in that particular industry. Overriding all of our inspection programs is the desire to conform to a national regulatory program standard. So each individual inspection program has particular standards to ensure quality work is being completed. It starts with assessments from the regulatory authority, goes through training design to make sure staff have the adequate knowledge to perform their work, inspection protocols and procedures for consistency and focus on risk, making sure that we have internal auditing, good enforcement activities, as well as outreach and adequate resources to be able to conduct the work. So all of our inspection activities are conducted and designed around being able to meet those quality standards and really being able to have audit systems in place so that we can trend and we can make sure that we have adequate oversight internally for our work as well to make sure that when we're choosing to go out and do inspections that it's a good use of time both for ourselves and also for the industry, and that we're focusing on the things that are going to have the greatest public health impact, but also are meeting regulatory requirements and that we have good documentation in place for the cases that we make. Trends and challenges that we're seeing. So there is quite a bit of effort that has gone for supporting operators and other public health response related to COVID-19. A lot of our efforts are about coordination. So working actively with various segments of the Department of Health and how to best support the food industry across the food chain. So whether it's working with growers, packing facilities, and then out for retail facilities about how it is that they can modify practices or how they can implement or have best access to information about practices related to COVID-19. Even though it's not a food safety issue, it's definitely a nexus where we can provide access to information and help get needs met. Something that we're seeing is a lot of operators that are either new to food production or new to food safety practices. And so a lot of new businesses, and this can be folks who are just getting into the business, for example, cottage food operators who are looking to grow their business, or folks who are good business operators who are looking to expand into food but may not have that background in food safety. The reason why this matters is because it really does take a lot of resources on our side for our inspectors when they go through that licensing process to make sure that they're providing adequate support and outreach so that those operators can be successful and have access to good practices. We also have quite a bit of continued industry innovation for both products and processes. And so this is about changes in the industry itself. So, you know, whether it's new packaging, whether it's new types of products that are being sought or developed, new distribution styles, anything like that, it poses, some challenges for our staff in making sure that we have adequate food safety knowledge and to figure out how to make some of these new products and processes, figure out how they fit with our existing regulatory scheme, to figure out what's the right regulations to apply to some of these, or what's the best practices that we can have and how we inspect them. There's also an increase in the complexity of business ownership, sales, and distribution structures. An example of this is just think about, the growth of Instacart, all these other online delivery platforms. A lot of these are actually run by third parties. And based on the licensing structure in Minnesota, we're really based on who owns the food and the place of business where they sell it. And that can become a challenge in, the new age of technology, but also in new ways to distribute product effectively. We saw this come up with some of farmers markets, and we're looking at doing combining products and being able to offer more efficient delivery to some of the customers. And so that's kind of, we're trying to figure out what's the best way we can fit these new new sales styles into the existing regulations that we do have. There's also changes in the consumer product handling and consumption patterns that continues to, be evolving. again, an example of this is a classic cookie dough example. Cookie dough in of itself and how we inspected it and how we evaluated it for risk was about it being made into a cookie. But as consumption patterns change over time, that then changes the expectation of how to handle that food safely and what an operator needs to do in order to distribute it. And of course, we also have continued advancements in the actual science of food safety, as well as our outbreak response. That technology continues to evolve and get better, but it also then loops back into our interactions with the manufacturers and distributors and retailers, both at the human food as well as animal food, to figure out how it is that we can work effectively and get ahead and be in a more prevention-oriented space. Next slide. In terms of the governor's budget recommendations, something that we have in there is about dedicating our food license fees. So across all of our programs, you'll see we've got a variety of funding sources, but when it comes to food license fees, and this is both for manufactured food as well as retail food, currently none of these fees are dedicated for licensing. There's a few minor dedicated industry-specific fees in manufactured food, and there's some service fees in retail food, but it is a minority. And so we are seeking to get the revenues that are generated from the food handling activity license fees and the vending machine inspection fees dedicated to the agricultural fund. The reason why we're seeking this is so that we can be more adaptable. So we would like to have overall, a balance between general funds and these dedicated funds to make sure that we have stability in the program. But by having these funds dedicated, we'll be able to have some better long-term planning in terms of industry support changes. So again, efficiencies in our licensing administration, how we respond how we respond to some of our outreach needs, being able to be more adaptable and better, more planful in how we modernize. But also we want to have the ability to evolve with our industry more in a more timely fashion. And so this is one of the mechanisms to do that. Majority of our funds are expended on salary, and majority of our staff are highly technical staff. And so as the industry grows, we want to make sure that we have the ability to add on the additional staff to meet those needs and be able to do it in a more responsive manner. Next slide. And that's all that I had for my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Simon, for the presentation. It's good to hear from MDA and the governor's recommendation, so we know as we go into session what we can do. I see that Chair Sundin has returned. So I will return, before I return the gavel to Chair Sundin, I will open up the floor to members if they have any questions. And I can ask the first question too. Ms. Simon, I do have a question regarding the cottage food registrants. And, have you guys seen an increase of the cottage food industry since the pandemic? Or is there a growing trend on that?
Madam Chair, I would say yes. We have seen an increase, but I'll put some parameters around that. It has been growing every year since the registration was initiated, and so at that point, our growth I think is probably still within the trajectory that we were expecting, but it has been quite rapid, where we're adding on at least a few hundred new registrants every year.
Thank you for that. Chair Sundin, can I return the gavel to you, or would you like me to continue on to finish the questions this before we move on to the next section?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Please continue chairing the entire meeting today. I need to break away again, and I don't want to interrupt more than once already. So please continue.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chair Sundin. I see Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Simon. I believe you had the information on the feed ingredients, feed inspection. I know at least a couple of our early outbreaks of Palmer amaranth were traced back to feed ingredients from out-of-state rice hulls or something like that from out of Minnesota. Do we just accept labels on ingredients as they come in from out of state, or how have you handled that situation, especially in light of possible contamination with the Palmer amaranth and some of our feed ingredients coming into the state?
Representative, in terms of that question, I will say the feed regulations are, I'll admittedly, my weakest area of expertise. In terms of Palmer amaranth, though, our feed inspection program does work with our noxious weed program. And so our feed staff have been involved in some of their measures to be able to prevent the inlet. But I'm not aware of there being anything specific to the prevention of that, specific to the feed regulations at this point. I can go back and I can get some more detailed information for you, though.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Well, I'd appreciate that. That's my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is probably going to be for Dr. Nesser. I'm wondering about the meat inspection and things like that, and probably more on the enforcement side. During this pandemic, we've seen, you know, there was a limited number of spaces available in processing, and it came filled up quickly. And I've seen like on Facebook Marketplace meat that was, you know, sold, maybe processed at a not for sale or a, you know, custom processing plant. That, and I've seen some, I'm assuming was home butchered. They were, was packaged in a Ziploc bag labeled hamburger for sale. And you know what, and that threw my red flags right away when I saw that. But you know what has kind of been the last few months? What is kind of the philosophy behind how this should be carried out and enforced, the laws that we do have?
Dr. Nesser?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, that's a good question. We did anticipate with the shortage of slaughter space during the pandemic that we would expect, or we would see a lot of compliance issues with selling of not for sale meat or just selling of uninspected, any, you know, whatever people had processed. And I think we were maybe a bit pleasantly surprised is that things seemed to go a little bit better than we expected, as and we did do a couple of outreach webinars in late spring and early summer, which we had very good attendance, and people were really appreciative of learning what are the rules and what are the regulations. And, you know, so I think there was a good effort out there to comply. I would, you know, concur, though, I think the last 3 to 5 months, we really have been seen a lot of what you talked about on Facebook and other sort of online marketplaces. And so we've started to focus our efforts a little bit more there. We did actually just recently release a social media information sheet on not for sale meat, because people seem to be a bit confused about what not for sale means, even though we see not for sale, thinking clearly this should not be sold, but people are thinking about that as well. It means it just can't be sold at the grocery store. No, that's not really what it means, but, you know, people are still somewhat confused about that. And so we have been doing a lot of outreach on those online platforms in terms of how we approach those situations. First off, it's often very difficult to get the contact information or to really, you know, sort of track down, for lack of a better word, of the individual behind some of those postings and those scenarios. If we do have enough information, typically we start with what's called just a letter of information, like, hey, you know, we saw that you were doing this. Here's the requirements. And most of the time, that's really all it takes is most of the time just, hey, you know, these are the requirements. And oftentimes people are just not aware of what their requirements are, or, you know, they had, you know, 30 pounds of extra ground beef, they thought they would sell it, and not realizing that they couldn't do that. And so, you know, if we really have to go another step, next step would be like a letter of warning. Typically for us to issue a letter of warning, we would have to do sort of an evidentiary based case investigation where we would prove that, you know, you sold something that you weren't supposed to sell. And if we had to go farther, we would do, we have ability to do fines and those kinds of things, but we rarely do that. And oftentimes, like I said, most of the time, the letter of warning is sufficient In fact, we leveled no fines this past year. In fact, and we didn't do most of the letters of warning we issued were sort of on the traditional, similar to how we kind of normally do them, kind of operations. So, but it's definitely an ever-changing target. And so, you know, that online world moves pretty fast. And so we've started to work with some of the administrators of those pages as well to help them understand what the requirements are, because most of them really want products to be that are sold on their, on the marketplace or those pages to be legally sold products. So those are some of the strategies that we've been using.
Follow up, Representative Nelson.
I just thank you for that answer.
Sounds good. Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you. And mine's kind of a follow up of the same in the same vein for whichever one of you wants to answer this. This has more to do with groceries and retail and the different cart services that are available in e-commerce. How are we protecting consumers from the length of time that groceries are spent in people's cars for delivery? I'm very concerned about some of the maybe cold chain issues that we might be facing and shelf stability for refrigerated products that are being delivered to people's homes. And also, is there anything being done about people delivering groceries with pets in their cars and things like that? There are a whole multitude of small infractions that might impact the health of our community. And I'm just wondering if those are being looked at or thought about.
Dr. Neisser or Ms. Simon? Ms. Simon?
Madam Chair, Representative. So yes, the how that's handled at retail is that most of the time we are able to address this through the licensing process. And again, this is where the challenge that I presented about the differences in business structures coming up, it creates a little bit of a challenge for us in how to address it. But the way that we've been addressing that is through when we are aware of this, of these sales structures, we identify who's the responsible party. And part of what we do is, again, through that licensing, we review their processes and the activities to ensure that these questions are answered. So again, this is a generalized statement. Well, we review what facilities are available for as products are actually pulled and organized into orders and how are they maintained, if they're getting picked up versus delivery. And then when it comes to delivery services, we figure out what's the actual mechanisms for how it is that they're being delivered, because there's quite a bit of variation. The challenges come into play when we have larger corporations that may be national corporations, and they're using the independent contractor services. And that's when it takes a little bit more resources, where we have to dive into what those contractual arrangements look like and what are the processes and expectations and how is that they're overseeing how those independent contractors are doing that work. And then it would be part of those, an assessment of those agreements to see what conditions are in place to ensure that that product is handled and delivered in a manner that's going to be safe. Part of this has to do with the actual extension out to the customer ordering and how it is that that is arranged. So some of them require certain delivery periods, an acceptance period. Some of it has to do with how it is that they do studies about their delivery materials, whether it's in insulated cases or times of day, other activities that they use to control those. So yes, it's typically addressed through our licensing review and then through our normal annual inspection, with the recognition that, again, our inspection process is based on risk. And with that happening, we get a bit of a snapshot in time. And so that's why we really spend a lot of time at licensing to be able to assess the full process and procedures and controls. And then when we come on an inspection, we're checking to see that they're following the practices that they identified for safety.
Follow up, Representative Cleaver.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine.
All right. I don't see any further questions, so we will move on to the next section. Thank you, Dr. Neisser and Ms. Simon, for your presentation. We appreciate your time today. We'll move on to the next item of the agenda. This one is related to Governor's Ag-related recommendations for Clean Water Fund. We don't usually have or see Clean Water Fund bills, but it includes a number of provisions that affect the Ag Committee. So just wanted to let members know that it will be discussed also in environment and ultimately in the legacy committee. So the first testifier I have up is Mr. Stoddard. Please state your name for the record and feel free to begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division at the Department of Agriculture. I'm going to be co-presenting with two other presenters, Brad Redlin, who manages our Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, and Margaret Wagner, who manages our fertilizer non-point section. We also have a few other staff available if you have targeted questions. I'm going to give an overview on our Clean Water Fund appropriations. Next slide, please. Or first slide, I guess. Here it is. Okay, next slide, please. So the Department of Agriculture has 9 appropriations totaling about $19.6 million. A significant percent of these funds are passed through. To get to this point where we have these recommendations, we went through a very extensive vetting process. So the process is run by the Clean Water Council, and the agencies coordinated closely with that. And we have a joint set of recommendations in the governor's budget and the Clean Water Council this year. It's a very iterative process with lots of questions and answers, and they really get vetted fairly well. In fiscal year 2021, there was approximately $261 million available for clean water funding. Of course, because of COVID and also for other reasons, there's been a lot of uncertainty on the exact amount. So the governor's budget right now includes $220 million in appropriations. So it was a significant cut from previous biennium, or significant reduction. Turns out, though, that based on the last revenue forecast, there is additional funds available which have not been allocated, something on the order of about $24 million or more. So with that, I will turn it over to Brad. Next slide, please, for his moving through the certification program.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Chair. My name is Brad Jordahl Redlin. I'm the Program Manager for the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program here at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Next slide, please. I have chosen not to go into detail on how the program operates. It is, of course, a whole farm, every parcel, every crop in the rotation risk assessment mitigation process that we conduct. But I decided to skip right to the results to report where we are now, while also highlighting the fact that on a biennial basis, we do submit a report to the legislature, and that has been submitted last month. So I certainly refer people to that document as well for information. So on this slide, we just contain the numbers as of right now. Actually, I'm going to preempt these. I put these together a couple days ago, and since I can tell you that the number of producers is now 1,012. The certified acres is now 718,340. I won't go through all the updated numbers throughout those, but a couple days time, things change. So we appreciate the work of the growers in the state of Minnesota. These numbers all reflect their work, and it's our honor to serve them with the conservation services that we provide to them. And the results that they're delivering for everyone, as you see in the tonnage of sediment saved, the soil saved, even the greenhouse gas reductions that we're achieving through these conservation practices that equate to more than 8,000 cars removed from the highways in a year, each year. So those are some of the results that the program is providing for the growers themselves, as well as the rest of the citizens of the state. Next slide, please. So the money, it's as Dan's chart showed, it with the $6 million biennium appropriation in the governor's budget was the Clean Water Council's recommendation. More than half, the majority every year, is passed through to our growers and local partners participating and delivering the program and participating in the program. That appropriation also has leveraged outside funds through FY 2020 from our beginning to FY 2020 of $13.3 million additional dollars invested in agriculture conservation above and beyond the total of our appropriations. And we have $9 million more dollars above that 13 that have been committed from USDA, federal conservation dollars coming to the state of Minnesota that wouldn't otherwise be here. If it wasn't for our application and award of a Regional Conservation Partnership Program award from a five-year award from USDA, our appropriation serves as a match for that award. And this is the second of these RCPP awards that our program has received, second consecutive five-year, $9 million award. So we're proud to have gotten that for our growers in the state. And then I just noticed the chart on the side there has shows that a program like this that never existed before anywhere has some high upfront sunk costs to create it. But we're proud to be able to say that every year it's been in existence, the per acre cost, that is total acre certified versus all money ever appropriated, has gone down and continues to go down. Even most recently in FY20, while the actually year over year appropriation was $500,000 higher in FY20 than it was in previous years, that still we managed to get that to be a little less than the previous year, even with the higher appropriation. So the enrollments are succeeding and the growers are doing well as we pursue the governor's 1 million acre goal for this program in by end of next year. Next slide, please. Real quick, hitting some things here. It's a busy slide, I apologize, but just want to note a couple of highlights. There's a lot of things to talk about. I'll just pick three. One is that our work with Minnesota State College and the Minnesota State Agriculture Centers of Excellence, where they have completed a study of water quality certified farms within their farm business management program versus all other participants in their farm business management program, and found that those certified farms on average are 26% more profitable, 26% higher net income than their cohorts in the program. So we're pleased to see that what is ultimately fairly logical, that the intense management and priority on resource management within a farming operation, entirely custom and attuned to that unique farmer operation, which all certifications are, do result in a positive in the bottom line. So we're grateful to see that Minnesota colleges have demonstrated that for us. The middle column there is just highlighting one aspect of the work that we do with this appropriation. That is, we provide supplemental grants. These are small scale, less than $5,000 a time grants available to growers. It can only be 75% of the total cost of the practice or management change that is being funded by the grant. But you can see that since its inception, small print there, but for instance, in the asterisk FY 2021, you can see already this year, several months ago, we've done $317,000 in these small scale grants and getting conservation delivered on the ground. So we're excited to see that when there's a need, we can meet it, and it's serving those outcomes that we saw in earlier slides about the conservation delivery for the rest of the state. And if you're curious, that also small print, but the top five activities funded include nearly $500,000 in cover crop funding alone, plus other practices and livestock affiliated practices as well. Finally, I'll just finish out. We do have endorsements added to our program, and more recently, a series of four of them that are available right now, like Climate Smart endorsement, an integrated pest management endorsement, wildlife and soil health endorsements. These are opportunities for growers who get water quality certified and want to concentrate further efforts in a particular arena, category of conservation. Those four represented have that opportunity to do so and be recognized for it. And I would note, as discussed in testimony previously, we have a Climate Smart Farms project proposal the governor's forwarded, utilizing the Climate Smart endorsement to provide a limited term bridge payment program for growers to implement climate activities in their operation, prepare themselves for the opportunities that all forecasts say are coming for climate marketplace opportunities, or even for federal programs that will provide climate funding. I guess next slide. I wanted to finish up too. It all starts and ends with the growers, but in delivering our work and in accessing growers and supporting growers, partnership is central to our work. We have some large-scale national partnerships that we participate in. The Ecosystem Service Market Consortium is bringing a, has brought a pilot project to the state of Minnesota. We're proud to be able to participate in that, provide in-kind support for federal dollars that are coming to that pilot effort. We are a participant in the National Field to Market Consortium, really an international. This is, includes groups like PepsiCo and Unilever and McDonald's and Farm Bureau and others. The we're participants in that level to work to find opportunities to just drive sustainability through our national food system. And here in Minnesota, we've been cooperating in efforts with EMBOLD, that is a group of leading agricultural businesses in the state of Minnesota, undertaking initiatives in conservation and other arenas. It's always a problem when you try to reference people here. There's too many to go through, but just kind of a sampling there of the different partnerships that we have, whether it be like Hormel or Land O'Lakes, Truterra, local co-ops like Central Farm Services, and SWCDs. Would be appropriate here in mentioning all the SWCDs in the state of Minnesota. They do function as essentially our spinal column, our central nervous system for our operations, where we provide the resources to them, to not be an unfunded mandate to anyone, but it is their contact with growers and their delivery of services that just makes everything we do possible. And noting too then on the kind of, as I close out the slide, the fact that the program is housed here at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, but it's full partnered with and supported by, encumbered under our fellow agencies, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Board of Water Soil Resources as well. I will stop there and we can take questions, I presume, at the end.
Yes, I just see one more testifier on the list. So we will go with the next testifier and then I open up the floor for members for questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Wagner?
Yes, hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As mentioned, my name is Margaret Wagner, and I'll talk about a few of our program areas, including Forever Green. Next slide. So the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota is developing perennials and cover cropping systems. These perennials and winter annual crops are protective of Minnesota waters and align with the state's goal to increase vegetative cover. This initiative is strongly supported by the agricultural community as well as environmental organizations. So the MDA works closely with Forever Green, and we pass through 100% of the clean water funding through to the University of Minnesota. These funds are invested in three main areas. That's research, implementation, and partnership development. The MDA's main role is to coordinate the state agency effort and to integrate Forever Green into other activities. Next slide. I'll quickly recap the research activities. To date, clean water funds have supported 37 research projects across many of the crops in the Forever Green portfolio. For example, many of you may have heard of intermediate wheatgrass or Kernza. So there's projects focused on that, as well as other crops such as pennycress, winter camelina, winter barley, perennial sunflowers, and others. This program leverages millions of dollars from non-clean water fund sources. Researchers very actively pursue state and federal grants, as well as support from foundations and industry. So on this slide, I just have an example from 2018 and 2019 that show the level of investment for a variety of these funding sources. Next slide. So new in 2020 was Clean Water Fund support for implementation. This is really focused on increasing the number of acres of intermediate wheatgrass or Kernza that are grown here in Minnesota and developing a model for commercializing Kernza. So the Department of Agriculture and the U of M have a 3-year work plan for this activity. Some of our initial outcomes, together we have identified and established partnerships in 3 targeted regions where there's coordination among supply chain partners. This is focused in areas with vulnerable groundwater. And the map on the right shows a general outline where the majority of the new Kernza plantings are located. A total of 1,172 acres of Kernza are planted in Minnesota. So this is specific to the new improved variety of Kernza named Minnesota Clearwater. Of those acres of Kearns of plantings, 32% are in drinking water supply management areas, and really looking to maximize the benefit of a perennial for the protection of groundwater. So next steps this winter, the University of Minnesota is hosting a series of calls to share information and recruit new growers. So you'll be hearing a lot more about this effort, and we hope to see many or some of you at a field day or another event this summer for Forever Green. Thanks. Next slide, please.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Dan Stoddard again. I'm gonna move on to the nitrate and groundwater topic. So the Department of Agriculture, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Department of Ag is the lead agency for addressing nitrate from fertilizer in groundwater, which is a major concern in Minnesota. Next slide, please. In order to address nitrate in groundwater, the Department of Ag developed a nitrogen fertilizer management plan over an extensive period of time with input from the ag community and many others. We also have a fairly new groundwater protection rule designed specifically to address nitrate in groundwater in vulnerable areas. The first thing that we did under the nitrogen fertilizer management plan was that we conducted what's called the township testing program. And what we did was we went across the state and identified areas that were high risk based on row crop agriculture and vulnerable geology. And we offered a free sample for nitrate to every well owner in these areas. And we did it by township. We actually worked on over 344 townships over a period of, I believe it's about 8 years, quite a while. Over 90,000 wells were offered a free sample, and something on the order of about 32,000 people participated. And this is a map that shows the preliminary results, the first year sampling. It was a 2-year process, and I'll get into the second year a little later on. And the red represents those townships where 10% or more of the wells that voluntarily participated in the sampling exceeded the drinking water standard. The pink is 5 to 10%, and the green is less than 5%. And again, these are voluntary participants, so we can't say that this is statistically valid in any way, but it does provide, we believe, a really good representation of areas where nitrate and groundwater can be a significant concern. What we do is we use this map as a guidance to identify those areas where additional work should be done, and local units of government are also using it in that same map. Next slide, please. So the nitrate and groundwater funding actually covers a wide variety of tasks, many of which are done in cooperation with local units of government or local partners. So here's a list, a pretty high scale list of things that are going on. We work with local farmers in vulnerable areas, those areas that we just identified, to prevent, minimize groundwater contamination. As part of that, we also, under our new rule, work in DWSMAs, drinking water supply management areas, which have elevated nitrate. And so the rule prioritizes those and works on those. We have 17 of those right now across Minnesota that we're working on. And we also have regional efforts with the University of Minnesota Extension and local governments to promote BMPs and other practices to reduce nitrate in vulnerable areas. We monitor groundwater on different scales. We have regional monitoring networks to determine long-term trends in nitrate and groundwater. We've spent significant resources to develop computer modeling tools, which we can use to quantify the impact of different agricultural practices on water quality. So one of the challenges that we face with nitrates in groundwater is that there can be a very long lag time between when actions on the land surface actually have an impact on water quality. So we've invested a lot of funding and work closely with the University of Minnesota and modeling experts at the university to develop these tools so that we can estimate the benefits of different practices. And then we have a variety of demonstration sites to validate nitrogen fertilizer recommendations and water quality impacts, including under irrigated agriculture. Next slide, please. So one of our key roles is developing nitrogen fertilizer best management practices and promoting them. So keyword here is nitrogen fertilizer. There's best management practices for a variety of different things, but we're really focused on making sure that fertilizer is used as efficiently as possible to minimize potential impacts on the environment while maintaining profitability. We have a number of demonstration sites around the state, including cooperative efforts. We work with local units of government to promote these practices. We one of them that's really prominent is Rochelle Farm, where we've done a bunch of demonstration work and evaluating different practices. We also fund two positions at the University of Minnesota, two extension educators specifically to promote these practices in high-risk TWSMAs. Next slide, please. So the other thing that's really important when addressing and considering nitrate in groundwater are agricultural practices which can go beyond just the fertilizer BMPs. And so we spend a lot of time working on what we call alternative management tools. These are a variety of practices, in particular vegetative cover, that really can do have a significant benefit to nitrate in groundwater and in surface water. AMTs could cover a variety of different things. We're developing a new process for screening and promoting these AMTs. It can include a variety of different kinds of vegetative cover practices. They also can vary depending upon when we're working with the local ag community within a drinking water supply management area. They might recommend specific things, AMTs that are unique to their DWSMA. So it might include things like taking land out of production in a really targeted manner, or it might include things like new hybrids or precision agriculture. There's a variety of practices that would be covered under AMTs. Next slide, please. And we'll go back to Margaret.
Wagner?
Yeah, great. In this section, you'll hear about demonstration of practices to protect surface water and how we're working in partnership with the agricultural community. So these programs are supported by farmers and their advisors as farmers host our water monitoring sites, show up for field days, presentations, and really partner with us on many of these events. So when we talk about demonstration of practices, these are both structural conservation practices on the farm, as well as nutrient management related, and could really be adopted across Minnesota. Next slide, please. So here I've listed our core technical assistance activities. We have edge-of-field monitoring, on-farm trials, and support for the impaired waters process. I'll talk a little bit about the edge-of-field and on-farm trials, and we'll just mention that our staff take this project information and share and integrate it into the impaired waters process. So specifically, watershed restoration and protection strategies and One Watershed, One Plans. We want to make sure this type of information is integrated into those planning efforts. And a unique skill that we have at the Minnesota Department of Ag is the setup and management of these edge of field monitoring sites. Overall, we manage about 20 to 30 stations each year, many of which are part of the programs I'll discuss. So what you see on the right hand of the slide is monitoring equipment that we use at these edge of field sites. This is used for the Root River Field to Stream Partnership, which we've had an opportunity to talk about in the past, as well as Discovery Farms Minnesota. It's automated equipment that collects samples every time runoff occurs. These sites provide a really robust data set that helps to quantify the frequency and intensity of runoff through the entire year, even in frozen soil conditions, as we like to show in that picture, and the effectiveness of conservation practices that are in the field. I do want to mention the Discovery Farms program and the leadership provided by the Minnesota Ag Water Resource Center. Each Discovery Farm has one or more monitoring stations that are evaluating runoff from surface and tile drainage and or tile drainage. The newest Discovery Farm site has a paired monitoring design where we are able to evaluate runoff from fields with and without a cover crop. So the MDA is a technical partner. We oversee all the monitoring equipment and data. And together, this program of Discovery Farms is really focused on farmer leadership, credible research, and communicating our results. So at the Red River Valley Drainage Water Management site, we are again using edge of field monitoring to evaluate conservation drainage practices, so an ability to actually hold water back in the field at different times of the growing season, as well as evaluate as one of the first saturated buffers. Next slide, please. So I'll just quickly share information about the nutrient management program. This supports farmers working directly with their crop advisors for on-farm trials comparing nitrogen management. This is a very popular program that fills up each year when we open up registration, And participants tell us that these trials paired with other on-farm data really help to inform their management decisions. What we'd like to talk about this program again is that direct working relationship between farmers and their crop advisors, supporting conversations about nutrient management. And it's a very low cost way to generate local data and to continue to learn from real on-farm work. Next slide. So I will just finish up by saying that we see there is a lot of value that comes from our demonstration projects. There's substantial outreach and education that are based directly on these results. We use this information to work directly with stakeholders and develop both tools and resources that are used by farmers, crop advisors, other agencies, as well as some popular new videos and other resources that we've developed for the general public. Next slide, please. Irrigation water quality protection is the last topic I'll cover. Next slide, please. So the Minnesota Department of Agriculture passes clean water funds through to the University of Minnesota to support this irrigation specialist position. Dr. Vasu Sharma is the irrigation specialist and is actively engaged in research, demonstrations, and outreach. She currently works with more than 20 local government partners, in addition to state agencies and our agricultural organizations. Next slide. So this position directly supports research and provides assistance to irrigators on issues of irrigation scheduling and soil water monitoring. I highlighted a few examples of outreach activities from 2019, since most of our 2020 events were virtual, but this was a good illustration of how she's taken the information from her research and really done extensive outreach in irrigated areas. So Dr. Sharma is the lead research position for irrigation in Minnesota, and she's working to develop and revise our best management practices for Minnesota irrigators. The outcomes are both working directly with farmers as well as publishing her work in outreach bulletins, scientific journals, and other outlets.
I do see that we have a little less than 10 minutes left, so if you could touch on the high points, and then I would like to move on to member questions.
So, Madam Chair, I'll finish and I'll try to move pretty quickly. So we also get funding for our laboratory to analyze pesticides. Next slide, please. So what we do is we get funding to fund two positions. We are able to get funding to buy a state-of-the-art, what's called an LC-MS instrument. Those two positions are used just to run the instrument. But you can see that was this change here when we got the instrument. It really allowed us to run a lot more analytes at much lower detection limits. And we run about 600 more samples a year. So we use funding for those two positions to run those samples. Next slide, please. And we use the data in a lot of ways, and I'll go over this really quick, but we use the monitoring data to make management decisions under the Pesticide Management Plan for Pesticides in Minnesota. We also share it with other agencies, the Department of Health and PCA, and they use it for their own purposes and provide advice to us on health risk assessments. It's used for assessing impaired waters, and we all, local units of government and others also use it for their planning and water management activities. It's all put in an annual report and shared with EPA through a nationwide database. Next slide, please. So we also have a pesticide testing program in private wells. Next slide, please. So this is part two of the previous township testing program that I mentioned. It's a two-year process. The first year they run the well for nitrates, and it's a voluntary process where the homeowner would collect the sample. The second year, if the person wants to, for any well that has any detection of nitrate at all, we will run out with one of our professionals and collect a sample for pesticides. Next slide, please. So the pesticide samples are really kind of expensive. We've run, I think, something like 5,000 samples in 42 counties. We do get some exceedances, primarily for a chemical called atrazine, and the real one that we find more commonly is the degradates of a chemical called cyanazine, which hasn't been used as a herbicide in Minnesota for many years. So we do see residual effects from that. Next slide, please. We also get funding for the Ag BMP loan program. That's about $150,000 a year. Next slide, please. So the AgBNP loan program is a very popular program that's used to provide loans to prevent, reduce, or eliminate non-point source pollution. It can also be used to repair or relocate impacted wells. It's got a very low transaction cost. It's run through local governments. They're grants, not loans, so the money continues to be recycled through the state of Minnesota. It's exceedingly popular right now. The interest and demand for funds greatly exceeds our resources. We do have some clean water funds that were previously allocated for this, and the $150,000 that we get right now is just used for administration costs for the previous funds. Next slide, please. And then the last one is our research inventory database. We get about $80,000 per biennium for this. Next slide, please. And what this is, it's an online user-friendly inventory where we track all of the research in Minnesota. So it's been upgraded recently in 2018 where it's much more user-friendly. And what it does is it makes sure that the research and work that was conducted in Minnesota that otherwise might not be available is easily available to everyone. So at a low cost, what we do is we make sure that we don't lose articles and studies that were done by different communities in Minnesota. About half of this funding goes to technical support, and about half goes to staff to maintain the program, and it's very popular. Next slide, please. Thank you. That's it for our formal presentation, and we'd love to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stoddard and Ms. Wagner and Mr. Redmond for your presentation. Next, I see a member question. So Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you, Mr. Stoddard. I was just doing a little research because jogged my memory back to 1989 and when the Groundwater Protection Act of Minnesota became law, statute 103H.001, the degradation prevention goal. It is the goal of the state that groundwater be maintained in its natural condition, free from any degradation caused by human activities. It is recognized for that some human activities, this degradation prevention goal cannot be practically achieved. However, where prevention is practicable, it is intended that it be achieved. Where it is not currently practical, the development of methods and technology that will make prevention practicable is encouraged. And we're now almost 32 years, almost a whole career time since that was passed. 11 years ago, we gave the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency money for a nitrate standard. Gave them over, I think, $600,000 to develop a nitrate water standard. Never produced. So how can we continue to fund voluntary best management practices and fund this monitoring that just admires the water getting worse? How can we continue to do this with tens of millions of dollars year after year, what adds up to hundreds of millions of dollars since 1989 in public money? How can we continue to do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, as you know, dealing with nitrate in particular is a very difficult problem because nitrate is required in order to grow a crop, and it's highly mobile. Even under the best of conditions, you can get significant leaching, and if the weather turns against you, you can get really, really significant leaching in a particular year. So we do take the non-degradation goal to the very seriously. We're doing our best to try to promote those practices that make a difference. We do have a new rule, and I know some people felt that it should have gone farther, but it does restrict landfall application of fertilizer in vulnerable areas across the state, and it provides what we think is a really significant step to addressing nitrate in public water supply wells. We believe, and I think many people are working on those practices, which can really make a difference, and in particular, vegetative cover. That's one that we are really focused on, and I think many other entities are. We still are going to need nitrogen fertilizer. There's no way you can't have nitrogen fertilizer, and I think there will always be some leaching based on the current technologies. But we are hoping and really working to promote those practices that can make a big difference.
Members, we only have a minute left, so I will just, members, please keep your question very brief and your response very brief. And if we don't get to the next member question, please follow up with our CA, Nancy, and she will take your question and get a response from it. Representative Lipper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Mr. Redlin. And you mentioned a bridge payment to carbon markets, essentially. And I recognize we're running out of time. I just wonder if maybe we could circle back on our own. I'd love to hear more about what that bridge payment looks like or how that would work. So.
Be delighted to, Representative Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lipper. I know that we had more questions, so please follow up with our CA, Nancy, and we will get your questions answered from there. And with that, it's now 2:30, so the next meeting is Monday, February 15th, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.